Hi, welcome to the Two Nobodies podcast. I'm your host, Rupesh Patel. Have you wondered whether democracy is dying or is in decline? I know that's something that I'm concerned about for sure. You see the U.S. presidential elections here in 2024, and politicians of many stripes are signaling that democracy is on the ballot. You have world leaders who are saying that democracy is being threatened. Young people have been polled and showing that democracy is not something that they really care about all that much. They're more focused on other issues, and democracy can maybe take a back seat. This is troubling, right? And so I have Maya Tudor, who's a professor at the University of Oxford and researches democracy. Her and I get into this, and we focus on India in particular. She wrote this amazing paper, Is Democracy Dying in India? Because things are changing there. There seems to be a different definition of what people have, of what their nation should be defined by. So a fascinating conversation on democracy overall, on various different countries with a focus on India. So let's get into it. Enjoy, like, subscribe, and have fun with this one. See ya. Cheers.
Welcome to the Two Nobodies podcast with my dad.
Well, hello, Maya. Thanks so much for joining me. It's so nice to meet you.
It's so nice to be here, Rupesh.
Yeah, this is a conversation that I've been looking forward to for some time, to speak to somebody about democracy. It's in the news. We're all talking about it. It feels like everything's just frankly going to shit or something. I don't know, but everything just feels like there's no trust in public institutions anymore. I don't know if COVID did a huge number on people. You're seeing all these freedom movements show up, nationalism feels like it's on the rise in many different countries. So to find somebody who is researching this is definitely an honor. So appreciate you making time for me. And it's on a weekend, and I know that's not always the most convenient time. I'm sure you have a full load on your plate. So appreciate you being a second nobody for me today.
Thank you. Again, thank you. I think if your listeners are taking the time to listen, then I should be, engaging wherever I can, because it is, as you say, a little bit of a scary time for democracy. Yeah. And to just be thinking and talking, hopefully talks and conversations that are in some ways pushed along by listening to the podcast, I think that's a real contribution.
If someone asks you the question, what makes it scary? Like, what do you start with usually?
Well, I start with the fact that younger generations are less and less supportive of democracy. And that is something that's really scary, because those younger generations will grow up to be, the people who have to carry forward our institutions and embed our political practices. And there's a broad sense that democracy, it doesn't necessarily matter so much. It matters less than things like growth. And it's something I teach students from all over the world. We have 50 plus countries represented every year in my cohort of 150 students at Oxford University. And I see among that group a real sense of suspicion about what democracy is, whether it isn't really a Western project of some sort. And that is also a little bit worrisome, because it's ultimately what democracy is the voice of people in their government at regular intervals and at the highest level. And that's the core insight of what democracy is. And the people who care most about it, and the places and times that people care the most about democracy, is right after they've been deprived of it.
You said that young people are focusing on growth. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think younger generations, around the world, as I said, care less about democracy. And so they care more about, are their economies growing in their countries? What that means for them is, are they going to be able to get a job? Are they going to be able to buy a home? Are they going to be able to afford to send their children to decent schools? And, these are the things that people care about all over the world. And to many, democracy feels like an abstract, a unnecessary but nice to have alongside those other things. And what worries me is that there's a relationship actually between those two. Those don't just move separately. So, you know, and I think much of this is driven by the rise of China and India and the world as a global economies, but global economies that global economies that are led politically by individuals who are not vested in democracy as the best form of government, and who are actually in many ways actively, especially in China's case, vested in undermining democracy as a legitimate system of government. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those are some of the reasons why younger generations, and especially younger generations around the world, are less concerned that democracy is something they need to have and want to have.
Well, I can maybe appreciate that to some extent. Like if the countries that those folks are coming from and they're more autocratic in nature, perhaps are experiencing great economic growth, prosperity. If those those issues that you described are being addressed, like who needs democracy in that case, right?
That's right. Except for what I would say to that is that democracy on balance, when I mean on balance, I mean, when you're running kind of, you know, statistical regressions and kind of looking at this mathematically, that on average, democracies do better on all of those things that we care about, on education, on health outcomes, on infant mortality. Democracies do better. So actually it's not a choice between these two things. So when you look at China, which again, what a lot of students and a lot of people who read the papers look at and think about, you know, it's an amazing achievement what China has done. And it has lifted, you know, so many millions of people out of poverty. And so has India. But China's growth and the way that it has done that, the kind of political system through which it's done that, is really unusual in world historical terms. And so it's not representative of what a country would get if they chose simply to move to autocracy, right? And it's worth remembering that the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, which has led this growth for decades, grows out of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, which were really, really bloody, difficult, violent moments in Chinese history. And they involved the greatest loss of human life ever, absent a war. So, you know, when you ask people, you know, democracy or autocracy, you're not just choosing democracy or an autocracy. You know, you're also thinking about what other things go together with democracy. And on average, democracies do better on all the things that we care about, which is, again, to come to where we started, is one of the reasons I worry about it.
Is it, do you think some people are not feeling that because in democracies, like you are able to be vocal and critical of things. And so, you know, there are going to be there is political opposition to government saying, hey, things are going well, and you just have these kind of more open voices, whereas in autocratic societies, maybe those things don't come out, like the bad things don't come out.
Yes. In fact, one of the most difficult problems for autocratic governments is that they don't know when people are dissenting. So something that political scientists call falsified preferences, right? So by definition, if you dissent in an autocratic country, you're in greater danger because the government has centralized power and you're not guaranteed the freedom to dissent. So because of that, you keep quiet, and you, when you're asked, you falsify your preferences. You might wave the flag, or you know, you might do the things that look as though you're supporting the government. But in moments of crises, things can very quickly bandwagon, which is why revolutions often look unlikely before they happen and inevitable after they happen, which is a kind of a conundrum.
Yeah.
And that's because autocratic governments face the problems of not knowing what their citizens think. And again, you know, China is a government that has gone a good way towards addressing that problem, because China doesn't actually stop people from dissenting against the government. Mm-hmm. What they do is they stop individuals from acting collectively. So you can mm-hmm. criticize the government.
Right.
I was just in China in December. Mm. And, I was surprised by how much criticism there actually was of some of mm-hmm. the things that the government is doing. So that you're allowed to do, but what you can't do is say, let's meet in Tiananmen Square.
Right. Let's have some mass protests or something. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. When you think of what's happening in like Russia, for instance, let me back up. When you, you'd think that some of these autocratic leaning governments are aware that, you know, if they're not capturing any sort of dissent, that there is a chance for a revolution, all that. Like history has shown, as you said, that that's when kind of revolutions happen. So do you know if like these governments are actively thinking about these sort of things, and like if they're just actively only just squashing things, like you're going to build up enough pressure that eventually something's going to tilt, I would think. So I imagine they are actively managing this in some way.
I mean, sure. No, the reason that Navalny was such a threat in Russia and why, was because it's a potential kind of focal point for opposition, yeah. for people to come and support. And so, you know, there's a reason why there's a push, or autocratic governments look at charismatic opposition figures and try to undermine them, and, you know, using every tool that they yeah. can. And we see this around the world happening. But that being said, the world is still autocratizing. That is to say that there, you know, we are more autocratic today than we have been in almost 30 years. And mm-hmm. the interesting thing to note here is that it's not that elections aren't happening. So most leaders, most governments around the world have absolutely learned that you need to have elections. So talk democratically, so to speak.
Right.
But democracy is not just about elections. And I suspect most of your listeners would just intuitively understand that, right? If you go to a ballot box and you cast the ballot, but there's no opposition on the ballot, mm. if you can't discuss whether the government's doing a good job openly with your fellow citizens, if you can't hear media that is yeah. critical and that exposes problems in the government, right? Then the actual casting of a ballot isn't so meaningful. Mm-hmm. So, you know, democracy isn't just elections. It's certainly, that's in a very important part of democracy. But if you think of democracy a little bit like a chair or a stool, right? That's one leg of it, but it's not stable mm-hmm. unless it has the other legs. And the other legs
yeah.
are, you know, a broad range of civil liberties, which allow individuals to be critical of government, media freedoms, you know, podcasts mm. like this, where people can discuss right. and debate, and also competition, people who mm. are organizing to say the government isn't doing this right, and that they're allowed to do that. And these are the things that really make democracy an institution and the and instantiate this idea that people have a voice in government. And so it's not that elections are disappearing. They're actually, mm. we have more elections around the world than ever.
Yeah.
You know, China yeah. holds lots of elections.
Right.
But it's all the other things, the things that happen well before the moment yeah. of election and well after the moment of election that is disappearing.
Yeah. With Russia in particular, like there's always this kind of speculation, oh, is there going to be this kind of tipping point that happens in Russia right now? The incident that happened was in the summer with the head of the Wagner Institute, Wagner Group or whatever. And I think everyone was thinking, oh, maybe something's going to happen with that. And maybe it could have, I don't know. But is Russia an interesting case for you right now? Or do you think, nah, they're they're pretty set. Like nothing's going to change with the way governing happens there. But I mean, there's so many Russian people who are getting drawn into this conflict in Ukraine, and just innocent people who are dying in from the Russian standpoint. Like you'd think this is having an effect on the everyday average Russian, right?
Well, look, I must say I'm not an expert on Russia at all. Yeah. But what I would say is just more broadly thinking about under what circumstances you get autocratic governments being replaced by democratic ones. It's pretty rare that you get that change kind of overnight unless you have a really well-organized movement that has grassroots support. And you don't see that in Russia. I don't see that and that is what makes that's why most revolutions or most, you know, mass movements for democracy fail, because they don't have a well organized base. So, you know, let's take, for example, the Egyptian revolution, right? And that was such a hopeful moment for Egypt. And today
you're talking about in 2008, 2009, like during the Arab Spring.
When you had Tahrir Square and you had a million people in Tahrir Square. And this was right after you had Tunisia and next door had, you know, this fruit vendor, Mohammed Ouel Bouazizi, self-immolated himself. And so people came out and they said, we're going to, you know, this regime, the Mubarak regime, we're going to throw it out. And it was an incredibly hopeful time. And there were lots of people that poured into this public square to say, we want democracy. And yet today, Egypt is more repressive. It is more autocratic than it was before 2012. And why is that? And that's because the groups that came together in Tahrir Square, they were not united in the kind of Egypt they wanted to see. They didn't have an idea of, besides not the incumbents, what we're going to govern on, what kind of Egypt do we want for our future? And so more generally, it's really difficult for movements that are not well organized and that don't have a real grassroots organizational basis, and that takes time to build. It often takes decades. So that's why most movements that bring down incumbent governments are very bad at replacing those autocratic regimes with stable democratic ones.
Yeah, it takes time and energy to sustain that movement, right? And like you said, everyone's got to be on the same page. If you look at the United States, then like sort of this, you know, everyone thinks it is like this beacon of democracy. And so much of America's history has been focused on revolting against, you know, a single dictator and, you know, the king kind of thing. And post-World Wars, like there's such a focus on democracy in that country. Would you say like this kind of decline even there, is that a recent phenomenon? Or do you think that's been building up over some time? Because like to undo a lot of a sustained effort to ensure democracy is fully in play and captured by politicians of all stripes, like I would think that would also take time to undo democracy. So is this because everyone, I think, maybe more nowadays attributes this to the Trump phenomenon and what's happened since he was president. But I don't know if this is something that's been happening for some time. Any thoughts on that?
Well, there are kind of, you know, there's the match, the immediate kind of thing that sets off that people realize, oh, my goodness, democracy is really in trouble.
Yeah.
And I think for many people, as you said, that was the election of Trump. Whether you were for or against him, you know, you felt that this was a watershed moment in democracy in America. But there were and it is true that democracies generally, when they die, there are a couple of patterns that you see.
Okay.
And one of those patterns is that someone comes to power using populism, and saying there's a real problem in society, sort of highlighting a key grievance and saying that the cause of that grievance is the corrupt elite. So populism by definition is a term that means that the world is divided into a pure people who can't be wrong and a corrupt elite who are the problem.
Okay.
So that's the kind of the heart of populism. Now, when people come and say there's a grievance and it's the elite's fault, you know, that resonates often because elites by definition do have disproportionate economic, social, political power. And when that resonates, then people say, yes, this person speaks the truth. And the question, though, that people should ask is, what is the solution to the problem being posed? Because the solution, the populist leader often says, is, I am your solution. Give me your power. Give me your vote. And then when that individual comes to power, riding a wave of popular support, they begin to dismantle checks on that power, which, as you said, is in America is so ironic because American history, right from the founding, is a story of protecting power that is not concentrated in an individual and a king. And so that's why we have federalism, right? That's why there's a kind of really strong entrenchment of state power in the United States from the moment of its founding. So it's something that is really, you know, thinking about the United States in that kind of long durée fashion and understanding that what is scary is that moment because of what it could represent. But I think a second reason that this moment is also particularly worrisome for American democracy is actually has very little to do with Trump. And that is the sort of deep polarization that we have in the society in general. So I'm sure you've heard this before, but that, it, you know, in it used to be, you know, several generations ago that people were more worried about crossing racial and ethnic lines and religious lines when they thought about marrying, about forming a family.
Right.
And today, the most worrisome boundary is a political one. And so, you know, we used to have marriages across the United States that were composed of people who came from different sets of political beliefs.
Sure.
That's less true.
Yeah.
And that's not just true in marriages. It's also true in neighborhoods. It's also true in schools. And so if you think about the public spaces where you would converse with somebody you disagreed with, they just existed. Generations ago in ways that they don't exist now. And that is a big part of the problem. You may deeply disagree or you may hugely agree with Trump, but you need to be able to talk to people who are from on the other side of that cleavage from you. And when that cleavage is not just a political cleavage, but becomes a moral cleavage and it becomes a regional cleavage, increasingly urban and rural is splitting along these lines, then that's worrisome because these political scientists would say that these are overlapping cleavages, so they feed each other.
Okay.
And that means that those cleavages are become more and more potent. And that is, of course, a cause of Trump, and it's also just it's a consequence as well. And that perpetuating cycle is also worrisome.
The rhetoric too is so amplified, like where people will say the other side is my enemy. Like, I don't know if that would have existed not that long ago, right? Like it's crazy to think that, you know, prior to Trump, you had Obama, who everyone was, at least when when the 2008 election happened, there was a sense of actual hope that people would be able to, you know, work with each other, and there's this common thread amongst people that, hey, we're all Americans. And then literally 8 years later, it's like we're all enemies of each other. Like, it's just fascinating.
Mm. Well, those may not be coincidence. It may, in fact, be, right? I mean, if you think again about the United States at its founding, it is a country which has been founded on a very deep racial cleavage, right? Mm. Right from the founding, the three-fifths compromise in the American Constitution is one in which there is a, you know, blacks are not treated as a full individual, full citizen. Mm. Yeah. And that has, you know, been a core part of the American story, mm-hmm. as of course has been the story that you can, you know, make it irrespective of your background. And those, of course, are in tension, but most national stories are like that, that they exist in a kind of, you know, they have contradictory strands to them. So, you know, the fact that Obama was the first Black president in the United States mm-hmm. is, and being followed by a president who is dog whistling racial animus is probably related. It's not just a coincidence.
Okay. Yeah. I that's interesting. Cause I don't know if that would be so apparent to people. It's interesting that, like you said, more and more, even with like marriages or partnerships, are increasingly with the same political viewpoints or parties or whatever it might be. I saw this Pew Research poll, I think it was in June of last year, and it said that as far as the top issues that Americans care about, you know, obviously right now inflation, affordability is at the top. But I think it was like the third or fourth issue, and it's like both sides of the aisle work together. And yeah. I kind of laugh at that, right? Because it just seems so contradictory to how people are living their lives, right? And mm-hmm. to some extent, right? Like, I mean, government and politicians are a reflection to some degree of society, right? Yes. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but.
Well, I mean, as you know, we've been spending a lot of time talking about the reasons to be worried, and they are there and they are important and they are real. But it's also worth remembering that, you know, American democracy and Indian democracy and British and Canadian democracy have been around for a long time, and they will very likely, you know, these institutions will continue to exist. And, you know, politicians, they are a reflection of society, but you do get progress on some issues, even in really polarized countries and contexts. So, you know, I taught this case a couple weeks ago in my course on we don't usually teach the U.S. because I said we're very international, but we did teach a case on the bipartisan Gun Safety Reform Act of 2022, in which you had President Biden signing in a bipartisan piece of legislation on gun safety, which, you know, a majority of Americans agree on. A majority of American gun owners agree that, for example, there should be universal background checks.
Right.
And, you know, for many decades, that hasn't happened. And you saw progress towards that. And so the question we talk through in the case is, you know, this is one of the most polarized moments in American history. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the most polarized issues historically. And you have a really strong interest group in the form of the National Rifle Association. Right. And yet you still get progress. So, you know, there are also reasons, I think, to be hopeful. You know, people will, as long as people continue to be involved in politics and continue to vote and don't give up on the democratic system, I think there are many reasons to be hopeful.
That's great. Maybe we shouldn't, that's a good way to sort of end off on the U.S. I do want to ask though, one more thing is, there is a lot of though attention on, this upcoming election, as there is with any presidential election, but the rhetoric around democracy is even more at stake this time, all that. But you just gave a really articulate argument about, you know, these democracies have been around for such time and they'll probably continue. In terms of the United States, on your view, do you feel like there's democracy is kind of at stake in this election? Is this consequential in that way? Or, yeah.
I do, not because of the politics of the candidates at stake, but because there is a candidate on the ballot who has said that, who has tried already to say that the very electoral process is illegitimate if it produces a result that that individual doesn't like. And that in and of itself is problematic. And so in that sense, if that candidate is endorsed, you know, that does have real implications for the democratic process. And at the same time, as scary as those moments were, when we saw that the very authenticity or the very respect for the election potentially being undermined, we also saw the democratic system working. We saw, we are seeing the judicial process working, and it may be slow, and it may not always work in the way that you want it to, but it is working. And I also have to believe, you know, that, I mean, the history is not, you know, the past is no perfect indication of the future, but an absence of knowing, you know, those institutions, I hope, and actually also broadly believe, will continue to work in the way that they have in the past to protect the sanctity of elections, of liberties, and of these broad processes that that have been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope you're right. Right, like there's so much at stake. How do you get involved in researching democracy? Like, was this something like a childhood passion of yours, or like how does someone go into researching democracy?
Yes, it's a, you know, it was something that I thought about a little bit as a child. So I'm actually by birth, I'm half Indian, half German. I was born in India, and then, you know, spent, my first language is German, and I spent time, you know, really kind of wondering why some of my childhood friends didn't have shoes or didn't have a second pair of shoes, and some of them had second homes. And so I studied economics, thinking that that was sort of a key to understanding this difference. And then my first job was working at the World Bank. It was an institution that deals with economics.
Yeah.
And I arrived there at the height of the Asian financial crisis. And I realized that almost everything that the institution was doing at the highest level was driven by politics and not by economics. And as that realization sank in, I thought I wanted to study politics more. And, you know, it's something that I tell my students in this forum, you know, what do you think are the greatest challenges of our time? You know, and they'll say invariably climate change or inequality, poverty. Some of them now say the threat of AI, but you know, these are kind of the things that come up. And then I ask them, why do you think we haven't solved this? Is it because there isn't a moral imperative? Is there because there isn't a long-term economic view in which we should be solving, right? No, it's because the politics stand in the way. And so that kind of brought me to studying politics more generally. And then I spent some time in Bangladesh working for the world's largest NGO, the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, BRAC. And as I was moving between Bangladesh, I kind of went to visit India during my time there. And I thought, it's so interesting that these two countries are so different politically, despite really speaking the same language. And I thought, why is that? And then I went to graduate school and I felt like no one had written a good book on that, so that I wrote the book that I thought I wanted to read, and that was my dissertation and my first book.
That's very
cool. Which was about democracy.
Yeah. I have a colleague who just told me about, because it was just World Mother Tongue Day, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me he's originally from Bangladesh, and he was telling us about some of the background on this. I had no idea about how when Bangladesh was a part of East Pakistan, and there was this uprising because there wasn't respect for the language there, and that, you know, there was a huge revolt against the Pakistani against West Pakistan, but it also led to so many people losing their lives over that. This is like a story that, like, I think he was telling me, like, in the millions, like, people lost their lives. Like,
yes,
like, I don't know how many people in the Western world know about this story, but it's,
yes,
it's remarkable.
So the book that people should read if they're interested in this is written by Gary Bass, and it's called The Blood Telegram. And it's actually a riveting read. It's a, you know, it reads like, you know, a detective thriller. And it is this the story of Bangladesh's liberation war, or war of independence. And I met people when I worked in Bangladesh, actually, whose family members had lost their lives in the 1970 war. And, you know, it was a war where the election of 1970 had brought to power a movement based in what is today Bangladesh, but what was then East Pakistan. And this movement was it represented a popular majority in what was then United Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And it was brutally put down by the West Pakistani military. And it resulted in what is, you know, almost certainly a genocide. And it's called it was called a genocide at the time by some of the people in the, you know, in the U.S. consulate in Dhaka. And that's what Gary Bass chronicles in The Blood Telegram. But it's a moment where, you know, and it just shows you, I think, also how much democracy matters to people who mm-hmm. don't have it, right? Because they voted in the election, the result was not respected, and that resulted in a mass uprising, in which, you know, depending on what source you use, around 1 million people, some say, you know, 800,000, but, you know, a huge number of people lost their lives, and, you know, this is one of those formative moments, and it certainly was. It was also one of those key moments for me that brought me to studying democracy.
These are these kind of stories that I wonder if they're not already should be taught to younger generations, right? Mm-hmm. To understand how fragile democracy can be. And, you know, I think obviously the big examples are, you know, the world wars and all that get a lot of attention, but there's so many examples around the world of people fighting for basic freedoms that don't get told, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, those are the big stories of around the world, but I think we also need to have countries tell internal stories of their histories in ways that are acknowledge the past wrongs. I mean, every country has wrongs in its history, and that doesn't mean that, you know, having had wrong committed in its past, that doesn't make the country a worthy political project. It just it makes it worthy if one can understand, you know, the ills and the mistakes of the past. And, you know, we live our own lives like that, right? None of us is free from mistakes. And so the same thing is true of national history. So I think acknowledging that, I actually think, makes it possible for countries politically to move past those moments and not let them define, particularly because people whose parents and whose families haven't had those histories acknowledged, they feel unseen historically. And when they feel seen, it can often be in the kind of healing process can begin to say, yes, you know, this was a country, you know, in Canada's case, in which many Native Canadians lost their lives. Of course, that's as true in the United States, or for colonial peoples at the hand of, you know, Europeans. And that is a dark chapter, and that can be acknowledged at the same time that we can still say the country is, it's a worthy political project today, and I represent something very different. And I think, I actually think this is a very important issue. You know, the issue of whose history do we tell, and how do we address the darker chapters of history in a way that allows us to acknowledge those chapters, not gloss over them, and at the same time say that's not who we are today.
I've heard that the Germans do a really good job at that.
Yes.
And I've never been to Germany, but I've heard that they are not they're not shy about acknowledging that about the history with the Nazis and all of that. And it's a way, although some I've heard that it's also a way they part of their culture. It's a way to, they feel shame from that, but they want to remind themselves of like that shame from the past. So I don't know how you, like what the right approach on that is, but apparently they've done a really good job at sort of acknowledging that history.
Yes. I mean, better than most. It's, I think, still imperfect. And certainly in my German family members, you know, would feel shocked when I visit the United States, and, you know, part of my childhood was spent in the United States, and, you know, they see people waving American flags and the sheer number of flags. And, you know, that's that at least until the last decade or two was relatively unthinkable in Germany, given its past. And I think that's also probably not incredibly healthy as a scholar of nationalism. I think one needs to feel proud of one's nation and acknowledge the past and its horrors, because every country has them. And of course, Germany has had to do that in light of its past, its, you know, its responsibility for the Holocaust, and its and of course its responsibility for the horrors of not just World War I, but World War II. And so you do see that. You do see that in Germany's museums, you see it in its history. You know, I spent a term in Berlin in 2023 in the spring. And if you walk around Berlin's sidewalks, you look down, you'll see almost every second or third block, which is cobblestones, you'll see these cobblestones replaced with a little golden plaque in the ground. And it lists the name of the person who lived there, who was then deported and in most cases died at a concentration camp. And it's just a visual daily reminder of this history. And, you know, that doesn't mean Germany has to, I think, be forever defined only by its culpability for the Holocaust. And at the same time, it has a responsibility to not forget that it was that silence, that you know, sort of not speaking up and not using one's voice was a key part of that horror. And that kind of history, I think, that kind of approach to history is something that I think many countries can learn from.
Yeah. On that, a lot of symbols that people that are kind of controversial these days, I get a lot of discussion are things around like statues of certain historical figures or names of communities or that sort of thing. What's the right balance, right? Because, you know, this could be very traumatic for people who have been impacted by some of those historical figures, either directly or indirectly. But then, you know, was a part of that country's or that area's history, and you can't just dismiss it. And as you said, you know, there's things to learn and reflect from that too. So I don't know what the right balance is, but it's and I don't know how to feel exactly on that too. Like, you know, in Canada, for instance, you talked about Indigenous peoples, and, you know, our first Prime Minister John A. Macdonald, his statue is you know, has been removed from certain towns, or certain schools have changed their names from John A. Macdonald, you know, but he was also a founder of this country, too. And so, you know, that one's been a sticking point for a lot of people. So I don't know how to feel about this, but I'm just curious about, like, in your mind, what's the right balance?
It's such a great question, Rupesh. And I think the most important thing to do is to ask the question, not to prejudge the answer. Because if you begin a conversation and you're talking to neighbors, to people who disagree with you, to people who've been hurt by that history, and people who feel proud of that history, get them all in one room and to talk about it, it almost doesn't matter what the outcome is from that. So that's the first thing I would emphasize is have the conversations. Don't shut down the conversations if someone wants to raise them from whatever mm-hmm. perspective. The second thing that it's important is that it's easier to add than it is to take away. Mm-hmm. And that's because people feel, threat is a much greater motivator than the possibility of gain. That's just human psychology, right? Mm-hmm. That's what we know a little bit from the likes of Danny Kahneman and many of the behavioral scientists that have worked in that tradition, that it's called loss aversion, right? If you have something and you fear losing it, that looms large in your psychology. So we should be very careful about taking things away. That doesn't mean that one shouldn't eventually take things away. It can feel very different when it's very present and when you're thinking about Canada's, first leader. But remember that, countries have always done this. In India, when the British Raj departed, British colonial regime, parks across the country were littered with statues of, colonial figurism, especially Queen Victoria's, that were taken down, and they were, they erected new figures. And, that's because, Indians decided, and that was absolutely in their remit to decide, that this was not who they wanted to represent them. Mm-hmm. And that's not erasing history. Mm-hmm. It's just choosing who to celebrate. And so, and I think that's an important distinction.
Yeah.
So in addition, it's easier to add. So rather than focusing a lot of attention on taking down a statue, I actually think it's very important to think about who was left out in the panoply of statues and myths and monuments and museums. And oftentimes it's Indigenous peoples, it's minority groups, and it's so much easier to say, instead of focusing on taking down a statue, to add people who celebrate and who represent the contributions of groups who haven't felt seen in the national history.
Yeah.
And so to my mind, I would focus, rather than on taking statues down, on adding. That doesn't mean sometimes statues shouldn't be taken down. I am a graduate of what was once called the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. It has, since I graduated, it was an extensive consultation with its faculty. And the core of the question was, what is Woodrow Wilson's legacy actually? And so there was a big discussion about it. And in the end, the tenor of the discussion was that Woodrow Wilson did some great things, like tried to start the early version of the United Nations. He also was responsible for resegregating American government at a time when he had a choice, and that's not a legacy that the school wanted to celebrate. And I actually, have changed my mind on that. Initially, I thought, exactly as you did, I'm not sure how to feel about this. Mm-hmm. But over time, I think it was the right decision, and but in general, I think it's difficult to start with those kinds of decisions. Start with the easier ones of creating new monuments, new museums, new figures on currency that celebrate people whose contributions have not been as recognized as they should have been.
I love that. I love the focus on adding and celebrating. Because I think for some people who are having challenges with removing statues, sometimes I wonder if people are thinking, we're just quick to remove these things now. We don't agree with them anymore. Let's just quickly remove them without having the in-depth conversation that some of these things really need. And then maybe sometimes people just feel like, okay, it's less about actually a statue. It's more about just making sure we're all understand each other and on the same page. And maybe that's the more important piece of it rather than the actual statue, which is maybe just the symbol of what they're internally feeling. Right. Yeah. I know I originally called you onto this podcast to talk about India, and here we are 45 minutes and we've talked about all these kind of other things, but you wrote this really cool article about is democracy dying in India? And I absolutely want to focus the remainder of the podcast on that. Is the interest in South Asia just largely because you're originally born there, or is there something else going on that's kind of piquing your fascination around South Asia and India in particular?
No, I am interested in, India is just a huge country, and it is what it represents to me, a country that has historically celebrated diversity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can say that that's true of a lot of countries, but actually upon examination, it's not that true of as true as one would look at or imagine at first glance of many countries. And even, you know, even within South Asia, compared to neighbors, it's a country that has historically, you know, not put a particular group in terms of religious cleavages or in terms of, you know, regional cleavages at the forefront of politics and celebrated that a particular fixed social group in the nation. And that's rare, and that's part of the reason that I wanted to study India, in addition to my own background. Even though I was born there, I left when I was one, so I have very little memory actually of being in India. It's also just a very important country, you know, historically speaking. So between the years 1 and 1500, India was between a third and a quarter of the world's economy, right? So 1500 years of our last kind of, you know, 2000, India has been a huge influence. And that only changed with the advent of colonialism, right? When India's wealth was really, was adversely affected by the forces of colonialism. And today, you know, India sees itself as reclaiming its place politically, economically, in the world. And even if you disagree with, you know, lots of things about India or things that you don't like, you know, there's no question that the next century is an Asian century, both through the rise of China and the rise of India.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for your listeners, you know, they just need to be engaging in a world that will be increasingly defined by these countries. And India is one that hasn't, I think, gotten as much attention as it probably should, you know, it's you know, moved from the 10th largest economy a couple decades ago to now the 5th largest economy. You know, by the end of this century, it will be, you know, second or third, depending on, you know, what relative growth rates do between India and China. So, you know, it's just a really important country, but it's also a country that's really interesting because it has celebrated diversity in a way that I think is relatively unusual globally speaking and in world historical terms.
Yeah. And I think that was also my interest in this is like you said, the celebration of diversity, and that seems to be maybe less and less these days. When I talk to family members, and this might sound so uninformed, but just, you know, when Gandhi, you know, led independence for India, this vision of, okay, you know, diversity and inclusiveness in that country to make sure that, you know, all religious stripes were celebrated and honored in that country. You know, it seems like all that is like being lost these days. And I kind of wonder what he would say about India today. And that's really sort of really what I've been interested in is that viewpoint. But this seems like there's a clear rise of nationalism in India. But I also, you know, there's this conflation between, I think, sometimes between patriotism and nationalism. And I don't know really what's happening in India. So, and I know you study this and you've written books on this. So maybe help listeners understand the difference between nationalism and patriotism first.
I think, again, that's a fantastic question to ask, because in my view, and in the view of many political scientists who study this, although not all, it must be said, there is no stable distinction between patriotism and nationalism.
Okay.
Most people want to say that patriotism is all the good things about being proud, having pride in one's identity, and that nationalism is sort of the dark underbelly. But it's the same coin, you know, and there's some really interesting work actually based on research in the United States after 9/11, which shows that those individuals who think of themselves as the most patriotic become the most nationalist in moments, and so of threat. So I think a really helpful way to think about this is to think about what is the relationship for any individual and any national to the non-national. So what is the relationship between Canadian national identity and American national identity? And I think I'm deliberately choosing those two because, you know, one doesn't have to think of Canadian-ness and American-ness as being in tension with one another. Mm-hmm. One can be a proud Canadian and have no problem with Americans who are proud of being American. Mm. But of course, when that relationship is threatened, when war is on the political agenda for one reason or another, then that relationship naturally is one in which the affect towards the non-citizen becomes a denigrating one. But it's not inherent to nationalism or patriotism. Mm. So the way that I think about that is, you know, nationalism is the sense of we-ness that individuals have. So a very famous definition of the nation is that it is an imagined community. And I love that definition. And here's why. It's first of all, it's imagined, right? We don't need to go very far back in world history when those clean lines on the map of the globe that you'll see when you look at an atlas today didn't exist, right? They're in human history terms, it's the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
So these nations are new. And of course they're imagined because they didn't exist in some cases more than, you know, a few hundred, certainly 1,000 years ago, very few nations existed. Mm-hmm. And, or I would say none at all. And so, you know, they're imagined. But at the same time, they're really communities. So again, if you think back really far in our experience as humans, most humans for most of human history lived in small groups of, you know, 150 individuals. Yeah. Communities were face-to-face. That was what community meant. And so the nation is this really interesting and really new kind of community where you and I may never meet, but we somehow imagine ourselves to share something in common. And I think this also gets to one of the core points that comes out of my own research, which is that nationalism is, you know, it's not all the same, that nations differ with respect to how they define that imagining. So in some countries, like, you know, historically India, I think before the kind of, you know, before the past decade, has been a community that is imagined in diversity. It's imagined a kind of unity in diversity. Mm-hmm. And of course there are cultural markers, but there's a kind of strong sense that despite having lots of different languages and regions and dialects and foods, that there's a sense of we-ness. But there are other countries like neighboring Pakistan, you know, Sri Lanka, which had a civil war over these kind of ethnic and religious cleavages, where a particular group became to define the nation. So in Pakistan, that was the group that was Muslim, you know, and when East Pakistan was part of it, you know, 20% of the country wasn't Muslim. In the case of Sri Lanka, you know, there was the majority Sinhalese Buddhist, but of course there were a small minority that was that was Tamil. And so these groups defined that when you have a particular fixed group that defines the nation, that definitionally makes all the other groups that don't have that fixed cleavage, whether that's religion, whether it's race, whether it's language, when they don't have that, they become definitionally second-class citizens. And some of what my research is showing is that when you foundationally create cleavages that are along these fixed identities, that it creates downstream opportunities for political entrepreneurs. And by that, I just mean politicians or would-be politicians to come along and say, those second-class citizens, they are the problem. And that's kind of why nationalism can be problematic for democracy. And of course, we've seen lots and lots of cases, of course, notably, you know, this is what happened in Germany during the 1930s and 1940s, that because there was a very clear ethnic and linguistic understanding of Germanness, that German Jews, who had been very well integrated into German culture in many ways, were thought of as the other and had their rights more easily targeted because of the definition of the German nation. So it's a very long answer to your question of why nationalism and patriotism are not that different. But nationalism is an imagined community, and the basis of imagining is really, really important.
So is that imagined community in India, has that been shifting?
Absolutely. That is the key way in which democracy is breaking down in India. There's been a rise of a political party that is actually, and I you know, people who don't know India may not necessarily know this, that the BJP, which is ruled over right now by Narendra Modi, who's the current prime minister, the BJP was actually, as a political party, was set up by a social movement called the RSS, the Rashtra Swayam Sevak Sangh. And the RSS, as a social movement, is a movement whose core animus, whose core goal, is the creation of a Hindu nation. And it openly celebrates, actually, in the readings and the writings of Hitler. This is a, speaking of the, you know, the what would Gandhi make of India today? It was a member of the RSS that was responsible for assassinating Gandhi. And this is the movement that has set up the political party that is now in power. And it is, the movement has celebrated a Hindu definition of Indianness. And it has instantiated that in changing textbooks, in changing symbols. And in many ways, it's not that elections are disappearing, but it's that all the civil liberties, especially of minority groups, are shrinking, and the right to criticize or to the government or to speak up on behalf of groups or who are having their rights deprived is also shrinking, because if you do, you will be called an anti-national. So this is all to say that the core of India's democratic decline today, which every major watchdog of democracy has downgraded India's democracy in some fashion to something like, you know, in some cases it's an electoral democracy, but in any case, it's no longer a full and robust democracy by any independent watchdog. And that is because of the rise of kind of Hindu nationalism that has politically enabled the targeting of first minorities, and you know, following on from that, groups that speak up on behalf of any marginalized groups.
And it starts with this imagined community now, of them now imagining India as this sort of Hindu state, essentially.
Yes. I mean, and it's a certain reading of history. So, you know, it's a nice link to our conversation earlier about the importance of history. The core belief of this the RSS and movement, which is really the kind of core behind the BJP, the core movement behind the BJP, is that, you know, it's very similar to the Chinese story that, you know, there's been a century of humiliation that has held China back and that the West is holding China back. And the Indian version of that story is that there have been kind of 900 years of various groups coming in to India, invading India and holding it back. And that has been because Hinduism has been soft or weak at resisting it. And so the solution to this is to recreate India as a muscularly Hindu state that is you know, reacting to this perception of weakness or the idea that India has been weak for so long. And so it is that reading of history that suggests the solution of the rise of Hindutva or Hindu nationalism.
Yeah.
And the mainstreaming of that in politics has taken the form of systematically hobbling what we earlier talked about were the legs of democracy. So though elections are still held, the possibility of actual electoral defeat is improbable. And that's because if you imagine like a chessboard that's flat and that, you know, you have major political parties competing against each other, you know, that chessboard is no longer flat. It's sort of systematically tilting with the kind of powers of those individual pieces kind of accumulating around the key piece, or in this case, is that's the chief executive. And so the possibility of actually a fair debate and discussion and a fair election is increasingly, it's increasingly less likely.
Yeah. You're talking about the civil liberties. You mean also like the press, for instance, there's not a free and fair press, I would imagine, then as much in India?
Yes. I mean, the press is actually one of the worst instances of decline. And that's, there's a Reporters Without Borders came out with its ranking in 2023. India is below Pakistan. It's below Hong Kong in its rankings, just to give you some comparative statistics there. And, you know, you might not, there was a study a couple of years ago by Christoph Jafferlow, which looked at 3 months worth of primetime news coverage of the mainstream Hindi channel. And they looked for they coded kind of each discussion of the government. And there was not a single instance in 3 months in which any reporting was critical of the government. So that's the kind of, you know, that's one face of it. Another face of it is that there's this increasing concentration of ownership of media. So a super majority of media today is no longer independent because it's owned by media or tycoons, business tycoons, who are very closely aligned to Modi. So that's both Ambani and Adani these networks, and they control increasingly large shares of the media. Now there are English language niche reporting that is still open, but you know the vast majority of Indians don't read English, and so I think in many ways Western observers, I actually think, are underestimating the degree of media decline because, you know, most Indians are not reading the same media that they are reading. And the regional papers that are in local languages and local dialects, they are more extreme in their support and their reporting. So, you know, there's a real inability of individuals to hear critique. And let me just give you one little anecdote that to me, to my mind, really sort of shook me and really got me to think about this, and was really kind of a spur for writing the article "Why India's Democracy is Dying" in the Journal of Democracy, that, you know, that led us to connect. And that was that I had early last year, a couple of Indian students at the school at which I teach got together, and they wanted to screen a documentary that the BBC had produced. And this was a documentary which looked at Narendra Modi's role in the 2002 Gujarat riots. Mm. Now, it was just, it, you know, did some lot of reporting that was, you know, I mean, really at a very high standard. They had interviewed people, and they, you know, they had went to the original sources. This was a documentary that was banned in India. And then the students who came to me, they said, "We'd like to screen it. We'd love to have you there and to moderate a discussion on it." I said, "I would be happy to." And they said, "But please don't post on it. Please don't have the school tweet about it. Let's not put anything on our website." And I asked, "Why not?" And they said, "Because we fear that our families will be targeted."
Yeah.
You know, and this is in Oxford in the United Kingdom,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the reach of the state and the chilling effect on everyday discussions, it's very real. They asked me not to WhatsApp them, because if I did and they went back in India, police will stop them, people sometimes in a check, and they'll ask them to unlock their phones, and they will search for critical posts.
That's China-esque, right?
And like Rupesh, that's exactly where I was going.
Yeah.
Not only is it China-esque, it's actually, to my mind, it's less sophisticated in many ways than the Chinese government, which understands that it needs to hear criticism to perform well.
Right.
But it's more directly repressive in the mainstream than I experienced when I was in China in December, where I spoke openly about some of my research.
Wow. Yeah, my next question was going to be around, because if the main press is being squashed and silenced, but what about on social media or like, you know, on YouTube or things like that? Do you know if the government is actively managing social media like China would? Or?
Yes. Well, I don't know. I'm not aware of any kind of systematic censoring of content.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do know happens is that there is a virtual army of individuals who are looking for content that is critical, and then crowding individual posts and platforms that engage in kind of open discussions and simply trolling. And that is, you know, the current government has been very, very media savvy in using kind of the new tools of the 21st century to strengthen its governing mandate and to intimidate individuals who dissent. So absolutely that's happening. Whether there's a kind of, you know, state-owned institution of the type there is in China, that I'm not aware of. But it, to be honest, it wouldn't surprise me terribly if that is. But whether that is less important, actually, than the fact that people feel as though they are really in danger, and they're putting their families in danger if they are criticizing the government. And that is absolutely how democracy dies.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, like you said, that sense of fear is beyond the borders of India, right? Like you have in students in your class who are feeling that, like, if the government had that intention of creating fear, they mission accomplished, even if they don't even need to follow up on that, right? It's already instilled in the culture. And yeah. Wow. What else stands out for you in terms of democracy dying in India? Like, what other factors do people really need to be aware of?
So the ability of the Supreme Court and the parliament to scrutinize what the government is doing. So, you know, it's hard to remember that just 10, 15 years ago, many people thought of the Indian Supreme Court as one of the strongest, one of the most independent. And there is virtually no scrutiny, no dissent against any part of the government's, you know, increasingly quite draconian laws. So the sedition laws, which were colonial era sedition laws, were recently revamped. And, you know, these were, ironically, they said, look, these were colonial era laws and we need to indigenize these laws and get rid of these colonial laws, which on the face of it sounds fantastic. But in actual fact, what was done is that the revamp took out the word sedition. Most of the law was the same, and it gave the government greater leeway to interpret who is speaking out, who could be construed as speaking out against the government in terms of what is no longer called sedition, but in actual fact is just speaking up. Things like, you know, the right to have a lawyer from the moment that you're arrested on these kinds of charges, that is no longer in the legal, the laws as they're currently written after these laws have been revamped in the recent months. Another really recent and important thing that has happened is that the government has changed laws around whether bureaucrats are able to have their pensions taken away from them. Wow. And bureaucrats are very, you know, very respected and powerful in India, historically speaking. So, you know, in the case of, you know, this is sort of a legacy of colonial rule, the kind of Indian civil service that became the Indian Administrative Service. And, you know, it was a job that was held in extremely high esteem. People who study for the administrative service spend many years studying for these exams, and you know, they're very, very well educated and trained and very powerful in the Indian state. Some of these bureaucrats, because they have, when they left their jobs, have spoken out, the government has changed laws to allow their pensions to be taken away if they are deemed as being too nettlesome. And that what that means is that, of course, that further amplifies this chilling effect. So, you know, it's happening at so many different levels that it's really, you know, that's very, very worrisome. You know, there are things I think it's worth contributing, though, to this discussion. And that is that I do think that many Indians initially voted for Modi in the 2014 elections because of the promise of economic development.
Yeah, because he did so well. What he did in Gujarat, right? Like, that was from my family, anyways. I know they spoke so highly of what he did in Gujarat. So
yes. Yeah. So Gujarat did very well under his rule, unless you were Muslim. In which case you didn't do so well. So Muslim socioeconomic indicators, just for a state that was quite well-to-do and quite wealthy, were at the very bottom of state indicators. So that already gave you a sense of what the governing formula was. It was economic development, but if we can't deliver on that, we will use the game of blame and of distraction and focusing on the identity politics that makes everyone feel good who is in the majority. And I think it has made people feel good, and that's one thing that has been really interesting and surprising. When I speak to my students, you know, many of them come from a generation where, you know, they don't know in India, they don't have a connection through a grandparent that was part of the nationalist movement. They have no connection to this kind of, you know, India that was under import substituting kind of economic regime. And they know an India that has been growing at, you know, 6-8% And they want an India that is as assertive on the world stage as they see China being assertive.
Sure.
And that, you know, and so that I think has been a big part of the support for Modi is this idea that India should be taking its place on the world stage. And, you know, I mean, I can't fault them for that. It is the Asian century. It is the case that India, you know, in world historical terms, has been a giant power, and it is reclaiming that. It just does feel as though it's a shame that it's reclaiming that by losing what has made it so distinctive to begin with.
Right. Yeah. Like you could have. Yeah. Totally. I can understand. Like when you described India's history, like you said, from year one to 1500, like India was such a economic powerhouse, and then after that, you know, just with colonialism, that kind of got reduced. Like, you know, it's ingrained in their history that for such a long time they've been kind of potentially repressed or held back. And so it's like, okay, here's our chance to really, here's somebody who's speaking where we can develop economically and advance India to where we think we should be. And people are legitimately struggling. Like the GDP per capita in India is still very low, right? So I can understand why people would want that future. It's unfortunate that it's had to sacrifice inclusivity and diversity in the process. A couple of symbols though come to mind recently. So one, India's, I don't know if they're officially doing this, but the shift towards not calling themselves India, but calling themselves Bharat is really interesting. I didn't know that that was part of their constitution too, which is fascinating. Do you know if, like, is this now going to be official change at all, or?
I mean, as you know, as you noted, it is in part of the constitution, so it has been already written and part of it.
Yeah.
Part of the self-identification of Indians for this their political entity. And there's more generally been a move towards indigenization of, language and a kind of taking away names that were given by a colonial regime. Again, mm-hmm. Linking this part of the conversation to a previous conversation about statues and symbols and so forth, this is happening everywhere. The debate about who represents the nation is happening as much in India as it is in the United Kingdom over the statue of Cecil Rhodes, or in, you know, the United States over, you know, Southern generals in Southern states, public squares. And again, one can understand a move to indigenize, to say, this is, you know, the we is us, and this is a group that has not historically been a part of us. And so we want to create symbols that represent something that is hopeful or positive, that we see as positive. And I don't necessarily see that as problematic. It's the targeting. It's the idea that, it's the ideas that Muslims and Christians and Sikhs are not a part of that tradition when they indisputably have been for thousands of years. And so when you take that history and turn it into a history of, repression and anger and kind of, it feeds a politics of resentment that is not helpful. I mean, India's growth challenge is it's a big one, but its employment challenge is even greater, right? So it's growing, but it's the number of youth who are entering every year into the economy and need jobs. That's a huge challenge. It's not just growth, it's also job-led growth. Yeah. And in the absence of having jobs, providing a kind of identity that one can be proud of is important. It's just that the nature of that identity doesn't have to be one, I think, which cuts out, large number, 200 million Muslims. Mm-hmm. That's just a very, very dangerous kind of politics to set up. And that in the long term, it will be distracting of a politics that focuses on things like employment and sanitation and schools, which are actually teaching and not just mm-hmm. getting children to show up and so forth. So, I do understand the movement towards indigenization. But, India, the other thing to mention is that India is diverse linguistically. And so one thing mm-hmm. that Modi has very much pushed is a push towards using Hindi. He's a very charismatic orator in Hindi. But Hindi is the language of the North, and the southern states of India have always resented the kind of northern push towards Hindi. So at the founding of India, Gandhi and Nehru actually thought that Hindustani would be India's national language, which was kind of the spoken dialect, which mixed elements of Hindi, but also of Urdu and other languages. Mm. But the constitutional compromise was not Hindi only. It was Hindi and English at a national level, and a lot of recognition of regional languages. So as Modi today pushes for Hindi, I think one very natural axis of pushback will be from the southern states, because they see that as a very northern project.
Maya, I could talk to you for like a few hours, and I recognize we're our area of time here, but we didn't get to talk about like the Khalistani movement and your thoughts about that. And that's certainly big news here in Canada because of what's been happening between the Indian government and the Canadian government, and even the American government more recently. Also just like the effects of democracy dying in India and what effect that has on neighboring countries like Bangladesh and Pakistan and Sri Lanka. So much more to talk to you about. Maybe we'll have to save that for another time, but I always ask two questions to every guest, and I would love to hear your answers to that if you're okay with going to that now.
Sure.
Yeah. So my five for dinner question is dead or alive, who are five people you would want to have dinner with?
Okay, so my first is not going to be at all a surprise, and that is Gandhi. Because I'd be so curious. He was a brilliant political strategist, and I'd love to hear what he thinks of India today and what he thinks a way forward to resuscitate a kind of politics that he himself represented. So that would be my first in our guess for sure.
Is it interesting to you that like, and I know there's statues of Gandhi around, not to belabor the whole statue thing, but that first big statue that Modi had erected was Rajalbhai Patel. And I would have thought it would have been like this massive statue of Gandhi, but I don't know. That was interesting to me.
Oh yeah. No, the Modi, the BJP and the RSS, they do not like Gandhi. Okay. Gandhi is not a hero to them. So, because he represented a politics of compromise between Hindus and Muslims.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Number two.
Right. Number two and number three kind of go together. There are two politicians who I really respect, different sides of the political aisle. One is Angela Merkel, and two is Jacinda Ardern. They are now both have left politics, so they'd be interesting to have to dinner because they represented, I think, a kind of courageous politics that was respectful, and that did at moments of crisis didn't give into a politics of fear, but tried to project a politics of hope and positivity, and even though they came from very different political traditions. So I would love to have them. And also because I'm increasingly involved with research that looks at the kind of structural difficulties that women in politics face. So there's this is all around the news recently, but women in politics get far greater threats, particularly death threats, there are particular kinds of sexualized violence on the internet that they're subject to. So it's a real problem. And I think that's going to be a huge problem that will only grow. And they, I think they have some really interesting things to say about how we tackle that. The fourth is probably also a real surprise. It's somebody who's living but isn't currently in jail. And that's Imran Khan. He's the head of the PTI movement that was very successful and was the largest party in Pakistan's election this earlier this month. You know, I don't agree with everything he's done, but he's a politician that has gotten the youth of Pakistan in a really hopeless, not hopeless, but difficult, challenging situation of Pakistani politics today. And he's gotten youth, despite the fact that elections have very rarely yielded anything positive, to go to the polls. And, you know, that's, I think, a really hopeful sign for democracy. So I'd love to talk to him about that and how to support, how he sees kind of, you know, Pakistan, but also democracy in general. He's one of these few leaders out there that is, I think, been able to really tap into youth and galvanize them. And, you know, coming back to where we started, you know, when we think about the problems of democracy, the youth hopelessness about what democracy brings, he's a leader that's been able to tap into that. So that's really, that would be really interesting to me.
Very cool. Yeah.
And the fifth and final one, my daughter would never forgive me if I didn't invite Taylor Swift to dinner. but also because I think she's also represents something new about our politics.
Absolutely.
She's a, you know, a woman who is, I think, a billionaire. You know, she's unabashed about appealing to the people who support her, and has used that kind of her fan base very effectively. She's also a kind of, she represents a kind of what younger generations of women who are increasingly taking their place in politics seriously. So she chooses her battles carefully where she's political, but make no mistake about them. She chooses them, and she chooses them with self-confidence. So that would be my final guest.
So Maya Tudor is a Swiftie.
Yeah. Well, I certainly have my daughter's a Swiftie, but I would say I'm a Swiftie too.
Yeah, she's got some good music for sure. I don't know. I imagine she's probably coming to the UK, or if she hasn't already, like, have you been to her concert at all? Or
we are going in June. My entire family
look
is
at
going.
You. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yes.
Those are hard tickets to get, Maya.
Yes. Well, you know, as I said, my daughter's in the top 1% of Taylor Swift listeners on Spotify. So, you know, we all do what we can for our children.
You're mom of the year for sure. Yeah, absolutely. No, great list. The way that the New Zealand Prime Minister left politics was very, I thought, was very courageous and very vulnerable on her part. And her tenure there was quite admirable. It's too bad that she left.
Because of threats against her, actually. I think that was a big issue. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Last question. Besides the circle of life, what do you know for sure?
I know for sure that we need to learn to live with difference. It's so comforting to want to surround yourself with people just like you. And I understand that. We all do that to some degree. But that the world is becoming more diverse, whether through immigration, whether through interracial marriage, right? Mm-hmm. Whether through, I mean, all kinds of ways that the world is becoming more diverse. And if we don't learn to live with difference, the future looks really bleak. So I know that we need to do that, and to find ways that we can do that, all of us in our lives, is something I know the future needs to hold. And I think relatedly, it's that a politics of division leads to nowhere good, because it's a politics of distraction, right? Yeah. In the end, we're all human. We all want similar things for our lives. And you know, I think working to not focus on division and difference, either politically or personally, but working on what binds us together and what we have in common is, I think, the best way forward for a hopeful politics of the future.
That's wonderful and beautiful. And I love the way you said that. Need to learn how to work with difference or live with difference. Yeah, that's beautiful. This is a fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed every minute of it. The time flew by. We spoke to so many different topics, but there's so much more to speak to. Happy to have you back if you're ever willing to come back.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was. I wasn't sure who to talk to, but when I saw the article and the way you wrote it, and then I've watched a few clips of and kind of doing some research, I was really excited to have this conversation, and I'm glad we did. So thank you so much for spending time with me today. And I know the listeners are going to benefit from this. And again, happy to have you back anytime, because there's just so much more to chat about. This is an evolving story, and who knows what happens with India and South Asia going forward. I hope there's... I hope that democracy doesn't ultimately die there, but there are some serious threats as you've described it. So,
Rupesh, thank you so much for having me. I am honored to have been here and to have had this conversation. I agree, it flew by. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, everyone, for listening today. Like, subscribe, do all those wonderful things, and we'll see you in the next one. Cheers.